John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Centre, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, October 12th, 2011. After 5 years in captivity, Gilad Shalit is to be exchanged for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in a landmark deal between Israel and Hamas, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas leaves Bogota empty-handed. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has been jetting around the world attempting to secure support in the upcoming United Nations vote. After 2 days in Colombia, Abbas left disappointed, with President Santos stating that whilst he supported the Palestinian bid for statehood, he would only endorse direct negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. While Colombia's loss is costly due to its key position on the UN Security Council, Abbas has already secured support from 9 of the 15 Security Council members, including two permanent members, Russia and China. Closer to home, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced plans to create a task force to explore ways of legalising settlement outposts built on private Palestinian land. After destroying several buildings in the illegal settlement outpost of Migron, near the city of Ramallah, and announcing plans to dismantle numerous other illegal settlements outposts throughout the West Bank, settler pressure within his government led Netanyahu's contact Minister of Justice, Yaakov Neiman, regarding the task force. While outposts built on privately owned Palestinian land, which too are illegal in Israeli eyes, the purpose of the task force is to legalise all other constructions within outposts and settlements, which have been built on state-controlled land within the West Bank. It is worth noting, of course, that the entire international community regard any settlements and outposts within the occupied West Bank and annexed East Jerusalem to be illegal. In more cheerful news for many, Israel and Hamas have agreed on a prisoner swap, which will see kidnapped Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, held in Gaza since June 2006, returned home along with over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. After months of secret negotiations in Egypt and Hamas signing off on the deal, the Israeli cabinet voted. With an overwhelming majority, only three ministers voted against: the Foreign Minister, National Infrastructure Minister and Vice Prime Minister. In the first phase of the swap, 450 Palestinians of Hamas's choosing will be released, while Gilad will be transferred into Egypt. In phase two, set to take place in around 2 months, the remaining Palestinians, chosen by Israel, will be released. Of the initial 450, over 100 West Bankers and 131 Gaza residents will be allowed to return home. Of the remaining 200, whom are to be expelled from the West Bank, 40 will be exiled overseas, and the remaining will be sent to Gaza. 60 detainees from within the 1948 territories will also be released, along with 27 female inmates, only two of whom will be deported, with the rest returning home. Whilst this is good news for the family of Gilad Shalit and the families of all those who are about to return home, our thoughts must go to the thousands still interned in Israeli prisons, including over 200 of whom are under the age of 18 and the 15 who are members of the Palestinian Legislative Council. That was just some of the news from Palestine today. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassam Kassis and myself, William Gibson.
Afghanistan reported October 11th. Horrific torture at or above the Abu Ghraib level has been found in Afghan prisons holding detainees associated with the insurgency. A United Nations report details beatings, electric shock, the twistings of genitals as methods used by interrogators to extract information by force. In many cases, prisoners have been hung from their arms and beaten with electrical cables until they passed out. This is while nearly the entire budget of these prisons is being paid for by U.S. taxpayers. Worldwide, ongoing. A keylogging computer virus has successfully infiltrated computers used to control U.S. Predator drones. This kind of virus could potentially harvest password credentials necessary to log onto the computer systems used to control the drones, and maybe allow external parties such as insurgents to take command of the drones and carry out drone strikes against U.S. targets using U.S. drones. This is not the first time drone computers have been compromised. In 2009, drone recon footage, a lot of it, was found on insurgent laptops. A $26 software program was all it took to harvest that drone footage, no doubt used by insurgents to keep track of U.S. troop movements and activities. That was a passive capture of camera footage. This time around, we are possibly talking login credentials. Afghanistan, Saturday. Afghan President Karzai admitted that the U.S.-led NATO mission is a failure. He said the U.S. and NATO have failed in their claimed mission to provide security to the Afghan people and that the war cannot be won so long as the Taliban is supported from Pakistan. The U.S., of course, does not have enough troops to occupy both Afghanistan and Pakistan at the same time. Pakistan, Tuesday. Suspected militants fired two rockets at a rally led by Governor Masood Khasur of Pakistan's northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province on Tuesday, killing one person and wounding four. The governor was unhurt, security officials reported. Baghdad, Iraq, Monday. A string of bombings targeting security officials and first responders killed at least 10 people in western Baghdad Monday evening, according to officials. The first explosion came from a roadside bomb in a Shiite neighborhood targeting an Iraqi army patrol, according to the police official. Minutes later, a second bomb exploded nearby, targeting a passing police patrol. As firefighters arrived on the scene of the first blast, the third bomb went off. An official said 19 people were wounded in the attacks. A hospital official confirmed the casualties. Basra, Iraq, last Friday. Two blasts cut off the oil pipeline network near the southern part of Iraq's supergiant Rumaliya oil field. The Iraqi government claims exports have yet to be affected, but admits some of the wells had to be shut down as there was no way to get the oil out. Mr. Barack Obama, this was an oil war, but after 8 years in Iraq and 10 in Afghanistan, neither U.S. forces nor the local governments the U.S. has installed to protect even the oil pipelines, much less the people. The occupation of Iraq, like the occupation of Freedom Plaza here in D.C., has a permit, one issued by the government U.S. forces helped install. That permit, known as a Status of Forces Agreement, expires at the end of the year. Mr. President, forget the negotiations for a new Status of Forces agreement covering trainers in Iraq. Forget bogging U.S. troops down even deeper in Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
The exponential growth of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement across the U.S. was a surprise to both organizers and activists, now gratified that their message targeting Wall Street greed in America's corrupt political system has struck a chord among so many Americans. Now in its fourth week, the occupation model that launched the movement in New York City's Zuccotti Park has now spread to dozens of cities coast to coast, with new organizing committees forming every day. While instances of police violence and mass arrests of hundreds of occupation activists in New York City, Boston, Des Moines, and other cities has captured headlines, the attempt to crack down on the protest movement has done little to deter large numbers of Americans from being drawn to participate. In Washington, D.C., the occupiers of Freedom Plaza on Pennsylvania Avenue were surprised when U.S. Park Police extended a permit to activists to stay there up to 4 more months. Conservative commentators and Republican politicians feeling growing concern that this new movement could have a profound effect on national politics have been quick to heap scorn on the Occupy activists. GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney has labeled the movement as a dangerous expression of class warfare, while candidate Herman Cain has called the protesters anti-American. Your reporter spoke with longtime peace and social justice activist Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange, who helped organize the occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. Here she talks about why the occupation protest actions have had so much resonance with the American people and the future direction of this new populist movement.
We are on Pennsylvania Avenue. I mean, I want your listeners to just think about it. We are camped out on Pennsylvania Avenue in the heart of this nation's capital. The fact that today the Park Police, who were ready to throw us out last night because we had a 4-day permit that expired, met with us today, and without us even asking, we were not going to ask for a permit. We were going to stay here unpermitted, willing to go to jail. And they came and said, well, without you even asking, we have extended your permit for 4 months. A pretty extraordinary development. We will be on the square now for quite a long time and building a community in an area that is not known for this kind of thing, to put it mildly. This is the center of dog-eat-dog power. This is the center of hypocrisy. While Wall Street is the center of corruption, we've got not only our corruption here, but we've got the great hypocrites that pretend to represent the people and instead represent the Wall Street and the other titans of industry. So to be camped out right on Pennsylvania with police saying we could be here for another 4 months, Scott, we have a great food tent, and I just went up to get some food, and they said, we have ice cream for dessert. And I said, who donated that? They said, the police did. So we're seeing magic happen here, as it's happened all throughout North Africa and is happening in New York every single day. The magic is coming to the nation's capital.
Medea, what do you think the timing of all this is? A lot of activists were frustrated that there wasn't more action in the streets after this huge economic collapse in late 2007, early 2008. And why do you think the time was right now for the actions to take off such a fever pitch all across the country, dozens and dozens of cities jumping on board? What about the timing here is right, do you think?
I think there is a tremendous frustration that has been growing. It really needed the right moment to ignite it, and the right symbolism. And I think Wall Street is the right symbolism for it. I think the fact that we are starting to get into another round of elections that people are really disgusted about. It took time for many people who were Obama supporters to start realizing that being quiet was not helping, that it was important to mobilize separate from the Democratic Party. that it, as we go into election season, we can't be co-opted by the sucking sound of people dropping everything, all of their issues, to get another Democrat elected to either the presidency or to take over the House, that this has to be independent. So I think there's a number of factors that came together to make this the right timing, but part of it is that it had to sink in for people that Obama is not going to either end the wars, save the environment, provide workers with the kind of rights that they need, et cetera, et cetera. And that if we rely on Democratic Party-affiliated organizations, they're just going to take us in the wrong direction.
Mendia, here's another question. As someone who's got vast experience in organizing on political and social issues, what are the key elements in your mind to developing a long-term strategy and to avoid the pitfalls of other movements in the past that have fizzled? What's your advice to the young people, especially, who are organizing something this momentous for the first time?
I would say don't get corrupted by electoral politics. Build a movement that is independent of the Democratic Party, well, certainly, of course, the Republican Party, but even third parties. We need a voice that does not get reflected by people in office, but pushes everybody that is in office. We need movements that cross issues that nobody should say anymore. The most important issue is X, because it's not. You know, we're tired of people saying the most important issue is democratizing the media. The most important issue is getting money out of politics. The most important issue is ending the war. There is no one issue. That as progressives, we have to recognize that our issues are all related to each other. And right now, we have the opportunity to make the connections that we've been talking about and yearning for so many years. So I would say don't lose this moment. Keep the momentum building. And keep that idea that we can build coalitions that with lots of overlapping issues without giving up the issue that is most near and dear to our heart, that is absolutely true, that we are greater than the sum of our parts when we come together in that spirit of collaboration.
That was Mendia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. Learn more about the growing Occupy Wall Street movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 7th of October, protesters marching from the Stop the Machine and the Occupy DC encampments stormed the DC lobbying headquarters of General Atomics, maker of the Predator drone, as used by the American government for executions without trial or the involvement of any court.
Rolling in on General Atomics, including actual drones.
Included in the march and coming into the building were a number of models of Predator drones, some on sticks. The larger ones outside were on wheeled carts with high sticks.
Our money pays for drones, those are my drones. General Atomics is being stormed.
Oh, sorry, got to exit the building.
Easier said than done.
They make drones that are for surveillance and for killing people and the extraditional assassinations of the United States.
Like what they did to U.S. citizen Alaki?
Exactly. And how we don't even know how many other innocent people and other U.S. citizens.
With Stop the Machine, the anti-war protest encampment at Freedom Plaza being solidly allied with the Occupy Wall Street movement, here's what one of the speakers outside General Atomics, the maker of Predator drones, had to say after the building had been stormed about living in a country whose wealth is gained by war and theft and conquest.
You can't live in the house of Tony Soprano with without thinking about where the goodies come from.
That is 1899 Pennsylvania Avenue, General Atomics, home of the Predator drone.
Less than a month old, the new Occupy Wall Street protests spreading like wildfire across the U.S. have already had a profound effect on the national debate, which up until a few weeks ago centered in Washington around budget cuts and slashing social safety net programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. With its newfound power to influence, the direct action movement has attracted new allies in labor unions that have made common cause with the protesters' grievances against Wall Street greed and political corruption. In New York City, labor unions joined Occupy activists for a march and rally on October 5th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and interviewed people of all ages from all walks of life and from three continents. Thousands of people rallied at Foley Square, then marched from City Hall past Zuccotti Park, renamed Liberty Plaza, where the Occupy movement encampment was born, onto Wall Street. There, two dozen protesters were beaten, pepper sprayed, and arrested when they tried to cross police barricades, preventing them from walking down the famous street that symbolizes the greed they were protesting against. Here, Melinda Tuhus talks with protest participant and recent college grad, Marty Peters.
I just graduated in Maine. I came home. There's not much work to find. I got a job, luckily, through my mom. But for now, I'm just living at home and trying to save money. And pretty soon, I have my debts to pay off. Another 15 grand, you know. And I'm one of the lucky ones, you know. I know a lot of my friends. I know a friend who went to Boston University. She's well in debt. Over $50,000, I've heard. You know, and I don't know what she's going to do, you know. It's like she's in a really bad spot, and a lot of us are. And it's frustrating, you know. Most of my friends, we hung out last night, and we didn't have, you know, we were talking about how nobody has jobs, and can't find anything, and all we do is just sit around, and I mean, it's kind of a bummer, you know. And so I'm just happy to finally go out to this march and just do something, say something, you know. Finally, somebody's doing and saying something.
We've been in a recession now most of the time you've been in college.
Yeah.
Did you expect something like this when you graduated, or did you think it would be all over?
The whole time I was in college and this is all happening, I just kept wondering to myself, like, why aren't people more up in arms about what's going on? You know, it seems like one thing after another just, I don't know, really was hurting our country and our economy and our position, our stakes, you know. Even though, you know, this whole the healthcare thing with Obama, like, I'm glad something got passed. But again, like, still, there's so many people without medical insurance. I mean, just looking at statistics, right? I mean, it's like the number one cause of bankruptcy, I heard, is this medical thing. And other countries, like, I went to Europe. I spent a semester in Amsterdam, actually. And it was shocking that, like, the people there were laughing. Like, how can you, like, how, why aren't people angry about this, you know? And like, yeah, the top 1%, like, pays a lower percentage of taxes than the secretaries, you know? I mean, that's just, it's backwards. And it's strange, and the right keeps trying to twist it around and make it some other weird arguments about taxing. It's like, no, just what happened to common sense, you know? Common sense. Like, they should be paying more if they have more. There's people with a lot less who are working, you know, working their butts off all week to try to make ends meet, 2-3 jobs, and they can hardly feed their kids, you know. And then you have these guys who have found a way, a loophole, not to pay taxes. Like, what was it, GE didn't pay any taxes last year. Like, what?
Ben Schreiber is the tax analyst with the environmental group Friends of the Earth.
We're out here, first of all, in support of all of the other important progressive causes, but we're also out here because our spending has a massive impact on the environment. We are in this situation now where we're hearing that we don't have enough money to regulate the environment, that we don't have enough money to afford environmental protections, that we're going broke. The truth is that, you know, the Bush tax cuts, the massive giveaways to some of the richest Americans are the reason that we're broke, the reason that we're having federal deficit and debt problems, and they're the reason that people are throwing up their hands and saying we cannot afford to regulate the environment.
So if you had one demand that you would raise here, what would it be?
So Friends of the Earth has supported a financial transaction tax. We think this is something that we should be enacting right away. The other thing that we'd like to see is a tax on carbon, on pollution, making polluting companies, some of the richest companies in the world, pay for the damage that they're doing to American people.
Do you see, with Republicans in as much control as they are and needing 60 votes in the Senate to do anything, do you see any likelihood of anything helpful to the environment passing in the foreseeable future?
The Republicans have made their job bill literally rolling back environmental protection and environmental regulations. They pressured President Obama into rolling back the smog regulations that were about to come out. They have made a big deal about putting out new regulations on concrete and other pollutants. It's very clear that the Republicans have the environment in the crosshairs, and they are attacking it. Unless we come out and organize and we make this a top-tier issue, then no, we don't see an opportunity. But that, you know, that's why we're out here. That's why we think movements like this are so important.
Paul Armstrong is an iron worker who came out to New York from Los Angeles for a job and has been spending his free time at the encampment. I asked him what is the one demand he would make of our political leaders. He had a ready answer.
Corporate lobbyists out of Washington. I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat. It seems to me that all politicians are in somebody's pocket. And it's not right that working class Americans have no say anymore. It seems to me that the leveling out or the eradication of the middle class started with Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics. And it has just gotten worse and worse since then. And for 10 years, we've had the Bush tax cuts that the job was supposed to help the job creators make jobs. Well, it did help them make jobs in Indonesia and China and India, everywhere but here. And we just keep hearing stories about from politicians about how we can't tax the rich because they need those tax cuts to create jobs. Well, they haven't done it in 10 years so far. So what makes us think it's going to happen now?
These interviews of protest participants were recorded by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus at the joint Occupy Wall Street labor union march and rally in New York City on October 5th. Find links to occupation actions across the U.S. on our website at btlonline.org.
The 7th of October, as both Stop the Machine and Occupy D.C. held space in Washington, D.C., protesters from both locations held a march on the IMF and World Bank.
You heard the word anarchist on the police radio. Hornets from the nest, furious about the policies that come from these institutions.
For about half an hour, the 19th Street doors of the International Monetary Fund's downtown office were blockaded by protesters. Finally, protesters left the IMF and World Bank and marched in rush hour traffic back to the streets of Washington, D.C., occupying streets such as K Street, where the wealthy lobbyists have offices. And where protesters didn't close, the cops blocked with their cars. On the 6th of October, protesters from Stop the Machine, which took over Freedom Plaza on that day, and from Occupy DC, which had already been in place nearly a week, laid siege to the notorious U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Here's what speakers in front of the Chamber of Commerce had to say about their behavior.
You can ask the Chamber what kind of jobs they have. They got a big old sign here. They say jobs. We want jobs.
Chamber of Commerce is not only bad for business, it's not only bad for the economy, it's bad for our democracy. This Chamber of Commerce pollutes our democracy with cash. It creates fake groups to
support campaigns of right-wing politicians and right-wing judges. They hide their money so people don't know what they're voting, who's behind these ads. The Chamber of Commerce is corrupting democracy around this country. But if you want to learn more about this chamber, visit stopthechamber.org. We've been fighting the chamber for a long time. In fact, their law firm hired a corporate bully, a corporate security firm, to spy on us, to do cyber warfare against us, to try to corrupt our websites, to try to follow our families around. The Chamber of Commerce was behind that, trying to stop political activism from occurring in this country. The Chamber is a serious problem. We're here for a good reason, to stop this corporate bully. When we're fighting corporations, you fight the bully first. And this is the bully we got to fight. Thanks for being here. Yes, we're here.
Good afternoon. Lives on the line who give their blood and their sweat and their bravery to this country, and then they come back to miserable conditions. They don't get the proper benefits they deserve. They don't get the mental health. They don't get the medical care, and they don't get the civilian jobs to integrate back into society. And I say we demand that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, don't let any more go over either.
Hey everybody, my name is J.D. Steer. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, Madison!
I worked on Barack Obama's campaign in 2009. I went to work at the White House in 2009 and 10, and I say that because I left the White House to go run Russ Feingold's campaign back in Wisconsin and fight for liberty and fight for corruption that unites us today. Since Russ Feingold's campaign, I have joined a human rights organization, the Enough Project. I'm here today to introduce a dear friend, which is fighting for this struggle in a very different context. And I want to connect this in my introduction to him. Okay? It's U.S. electronics companies. And there's a handful of billionaires fighting every regulation that we could possibly fight for to improve humanitarian conditions in Eastern Congo. As U.S. citizens, as voters, as consumers of these electronics, we have to stand in solidarity with the human rights advocates for the issue in Eastern Congo. And so I'm about to call up a dear friend of mine who's written a poem that he's about to perform that talks about this very dire crisis in Eastern Congo and how it connects to the issues that unite us today. So without further ado, give a round of applause, Omi Congo. Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Omi Congo. I'm a son of the Congo. They say when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. In our country, we have caught a cold, and many of us are dying. I'm going to share a true story with you all. It's called Welcome to the Congo. Every fight we have here for Americans, for jobs here, for health benefits, it benefits people across the globe. Here's the story, and let's say it's all, and let's never be silent. This is a true story. My beloved Congo, the joke of the African continent, the world's gold, diamond, and coltan mine. Rwanda's concubine. This country of mine, poisoned with the swine that is Western policy. Ooh. You see, Westerners and Asians exploit the riches, but live behind gated communities with underpaid Congolese security. So they're closing the door on fractured Congolese faces with one hand, while robbing her for resources with the other. Ooh. And no province is safe, because even some of our own corrupted Congolese leaders are involved in this race, but even they can't keep pace in the face of our Rwandan aggressors, annexing our spirit to their sick and stricken sinister soul. To such an extent that they now call Eastern Congo, you must dial Rwandan area codes as they toy with the possibility of introducing Rwandan currency in the East. The United Nations talks of peace, knowing full well that peace can only be attained through violence. Congolese rebel leaders becoming Congolese prime ministers can only happen through violence. Child soldiers fighting in fear of retribution on their families, joining the spread of violence, raping my mother country and spilling her black coltan blood only continues through violence. When I talk to you about Congolese genocide and Western compliance, your response?
Violence.
You see, I know because I used used to be just like you, sitting there smiling while other folks lie dying. Even bought my wife a diamond and probably spilled the blood of a distant cousin for it and chose to ignore it. But now why visiting Congolese refugee camps to find that there's not even any refuge for refugees? Abandoned Congolese mothers and children living in tents made out of empty rice bags while lice drags through their hair and their...
As if waking up from a deep 3-year slumber to find their standard of living and future prospects shattered, tens of thousands of Americans are now taking to the streets to express their outrage at the reckless and unaccountable behavior of Wall Street and big banks that hurled the nation and world into the most severe economic crisis since the Great Depression. Despite the official end of the U.S. recession in June 2009, a new study conducted by two former Census Bureau officials found that household income declined by 6.7% since the recession's end, more than double the 3.2% decline seen during the recession itself. To better understand the anger seen in the new Occupy Wall Street movement, provoked by the steep economic decline being experienced by millions of middle-class working families, Mother Jones Magazine reporter Andy Kroll researched income and wealth data from the last decade, which paints a grim picture of the harsh reality of today's U.S. economy. Among Kroll's findings were that middle-class families saw a 7% drop in annual income in 2010 compared with earnings 10 years earlier. He also found that poverty, increasing overall, is not just concentrated in the nation's inner cities, but the numbers of poor people are now exploding in suburban neighborhoods as well. Your reporter spoke with Andy Kroll, who discusses the grim economic statistics he gathered, which illustrates the severe decline of America's middle class, a condition, he says, that may be very difficult to recover from anytime soon.
What I did was I looked at data from the census about household incomes and what the average middle class family was taking home in a year's, you know, in just 1 year's span. And what I found was, you know, that between 2000 and 2010, you know, the typical middle-class family was taking home about $4,000 less than they were 10 years earlier. I look at poverty numbers, which absolutely exploded in the past decade, and really just in recent years, we have 46 million men, women, and children who are now officially declared poor, and that's 15% of the population. You know, if we want to borrow the language of the Occupy Wall Street folks, you know, the other 99% has had a really tough go, not just in the last 10 years, in the last 20, the last 30. And all this information we're getting right now continues to reinforce that point.
Andy, what can you tell us about the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the inequality that's been going on not just since 2008 and the start of this great recession, but the inequality that's been creeping along and growing wider and wider over recent decades?
The incredible income inequality we have now is by no means a result of just this past decade, this lost decade that I described. I mean, we're talking about going back to like 1979 is a place where economists like to begin their charts showing us how the inequality between earners and the American population has really become so drastic. You know, for the top 1%, you know, the top 1%, their wealth, you know, the average income that they bring home has grown from, you know, about $500,000 to nearly $2 million, which is quite an impressive increase since about 1979. But when you look at everyone else, the other 99%, if you will, or the bottom 80%, you know, it's really, the line is flat. You know, incomes have barely increased, if they have at all. And in fact, for middle-class earners and working-class earners, the change in how much money they're making is actually decreasing. And so this gap has been growing for 30 years, and it shows no signs, really, of narrowing at all. And that's a result of tax policy. It's a result of changing American economy and jobs being offshored or jobs just being disappeared in general, manufacturing jobs. There's a lot of factors at play here, but that gap's not getting any narrower.
Let's talk about tax policy, because since 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, we've seen a steep decline in the amount and percentage of money that the wealthy of this country has paid in taxes. The same holds true with the major corporations in this country, to the point where we have some companies like General Electric that pay no taxes at all, while we see the burden falling disproportionately on middle class and other working families. What can you tell us about that?
the general trend since the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration really is lower taxes for the top 1%, the top 0.1% even. And as a result, we've seen a concentration, a growing concentration of wealth in those very, very wealthy elites, and everyone else seems to be losing their share of the pie while the share keeps growing among that very small, small piece of the population.
As you look at all the young people who are attracted to the Occupation Wall Street movements that are sprouting up all over this country, what is it that drives that activism in your view? And does it have something especially to do with dimming prospects for young people who are trying to gather up money to go to college or have graduated from college with huge debts and really see no prospect for a career, for jobs in their future?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the things you described and much more. I spent the weekend in Manhattan, spent a lot of time at Occupy Wall Street down in Zuccotti Park, and I talked to young people, I talked to old people, I talked to libertarians, liberals. Yeah, they may not have a clearly defined set of demands, as they have been criticized for, and as a lot of people have pointed out, is actually a good thing. But the drivers of Occupy Wall Street, of all the other Occupy protests springing up around the country, and also of the protests we saw in Wisconsin earlier this year, is dimming economic prospects. It's income inequality. It's graduating with $120,000 in debt and having to work at a call center or busing tables. It is the loss of opportunity, and not just having someone hand you a job, but even having the chances to go out and find something. I mean, the jobs just aren't out there for young people and middle-aged people, of course. And it really is a sense of drift. It's a sense of disillusionment that the economy does not work for 99% of the American population. You know, the issue of income inequality and the things I wrote about in this article, you know, those for me have always been the most fascinating story and something that people needed to home in on, because since the 80s, this has been the real issue, is the widening gap and crushing student loan debt and economic opportunity. And that it really is the foundation of Occupy Wall Street. It's on the signs, it's in the speeches, it's in the Occupied Wall Street Journal, their official newspaper. And it's really the taking the issues that I present in this article and turning them into action.
That was Andy Kroll, a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com. For a link to Kroll's recent articles on the struggle of America's middle class, visit our website at btlonline.org.
The 11th of October, as Congress returned from celebrating Columbus's genocide, Native American people, about 100 protesters from the Stop the Machine encampment at Freedom Plaza swarmed into the Senate office building.
Tax the rich. That banner says tax the rich and the war. So grab the banner from people. Over here we've got an upside down American flag indicating this crash. Veterans for Peace folks. Peace folks are over here.
And the war. Tax the rich and the war.
We are the 99%. We are the 99%. We are the 99%. We are.
The high atrium of the building rang with chants such as, "We are the 99%, until the Capitol Police were able to arrest six of the protesters and force the rest out.
We will not be ignored.
We occupied the Hart office building, some inside, some outside. Went down the hallways, into the elevators, went into the balconies of the atrium, made a bunch of noise, and five, six got arrested. The rest of us stood outside doing our signs and just support.
The protest had the effect of shutting down the Hart Senate office building and preventing any more lobbyists or other such corporate visitors from entering, along with everyone else. Later in the day, in the next building over, the Senate Finance Committee met to discuss ways it could kill off more jobs, including brutal new corporate trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and Korea. Four more people, including David Swanson, were arrested for speaking up in protest. Still others, including Robert Naiman, managed to avoid arrest even while speaking out, as they were wearing suits and ties and weren't as loud.
This was on free trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and Korea, South Korea. And these free trade things that just take jobs away from America, and in fact, even in the testimony, the very first uproar that we had was when Baucus said, oh, we've got these provisional arrangements made that if we ever take jobs away from Americans, we've got programs that these jobless people can go to and learn a new trade and a new skill, and so far 450,000 of them have gone through the training and half of them have found jobs. And that was when we all went, half of them, you know, like, taking jobs away. Well, so David Swanson was the first one that erupted, followed by Shepard, followed by Carol, followed by Karen. And for about a 20-minute period, it was just boom, and then bump, and bump, and it was really good. And their comments about what they were concerned about, these treaties, to include for Colombia the human rights violations, the numbers of labor leaders who have been assassinated. I mean, the Senate committee got a real earful from us.
Yeah!
If you're a member of Congress listening to this, I got a message for you. The power of the Occupy movements is growing. And soon, the power of corporate lobbyists will be at an end. The time is now to say no to campaign cash from the banksters. Occupy DC, roll out of McPherson Square, bound for targets around K Street or who knows where. Crossing or stopping? Occupation indeed. 14th, the Constitution is locked up solid. Only things like ambulances are allowed to pass. Each one of those 1%er drones get through this. Moving off after having held the street here for about 8 minutes. Go on west on Constitution Avenue.
Yes! No! Washington Bank has got to go! Yes! No! Wall Street Bank has got to go! We are the 99%! We are the 99%!
Coming up 17th Street. You're blocking the street in front of the U.S. Trade Representative's office. And we've got the Trinocitis-Korea Treaty.
The 1%!
Not just in this country!
$5 million
jobs! We've already lost $5 million jobs!
Korea Free Trade Area, the U.S.-Columbia Free Trade Area. The two treaties that are violently opposed by the labor movement, the majority of the American people, the majority of the Korean people, the majority of the Colombian people.
On the 20th of September, I received a robotic survey call from the Consumer Energy Alliance. They started with two questions, quote, do you believe gas prices are too high? And, quote, do you believe unemployment is too high? Recognizing that this had to be a fake industry push-pull, I answered no to both questions, even though Wall Street has indeed thrown far too many people out of work. I then managed to start recording the rest of this phony so-called survey, microphone to telephone. Turns out the whole survey is about pressuring the Department of State to approve that nasty tar sands oil pipeline that 1,250 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to. Here's what my microphone got.
Due to U.S. dependence on imports from the Middle East, to build this importing pipeline, TransCanada must receive a permit from the Department of State that will allow it to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. The Department of State is currently soliciting public comments on whether to grant the permit and allow TransCanada to build the pipeline and put thousands of Americans to work. May we have your permission to relay your support for this vital pipeline?
No, you may not. I oppose the pipeline, and I wish the project would be blocked.
Please say yes, no,
no.
Repeat, now.
No.
Would you like more information on
no.
oil and gas production and the jobs that it can create?
No.
Are you male?
Yes.
Are you 50 years of age or older?
No.
Thank you for your time and views. This survey was conducted by the Consumer Energy Alliance. Goodbye. 7-1.
I should have gotten the recording more quickly.
It looks to me like the Consumer Energy Alliance is desperate to keep alive our bad romance with fossil fuels and dirty oil. No, I wasn't going to let them falsely tell the Department of State that I support the filthy Alberta tar sands mining. I'd rather see gasoline cost $10 a gallon than support a pipeline whose contributions to global warming is going to flood every coastal city, including mine.